This interview is with Tansy Rayner-Roberts. Tansy lives in Tasmania with her partner and two daughters. She has a PhD in classics and specialised in the study of Roman imperial women. She is one of the voices of the feminist science fiction podcast Galactic Suburbia. Tansy recently had a trilogy released with HarperCollins Voyager. The first instalment was Power and Majesty, which came out in 2010, and the forthcoming second instalment, The Shattered City, is out in April. Reign of Beasts will be released later in 2011. Tansy has also won the Washington Science Fiction Association Small Press Fiction Award for Siren Beat, which was published by 12th Planet Press in 2010. Hi, Tansy.
Hi, Lisa.
I thought that a really good place to start would be to talk about where you started as a writer. You started when you were quite young, and I wanted to know what made you start writing and how did you get into it?
Oh, okay. Well, that's many eons ago, so I'll do my best to remember. Mm. I don't remember really a conscious starting of writing. It was something that I've always done, like when I was a kid. I started reading chapter books very, very early. And so I always thought in novels, even though I didn't have the attention span. So I used to write a lot of page one. And I used to plan a lot of novels in elaborate, you know, pencil sketches and lots of 12-book series.
Is that because you read 12-book series?
Yeah. I mean, when the books that I read as a child, even when I was very young, things like Enid Blyton, you know, you think in long series. Laura Ingalls Wilder or Anne of Green Gables or whatever. Just about everything I read came as part of a series. So I thought that way long before I got to the fantasy genre.
And so you've always just felt like you'd be a writer. That's just what you should do.
Yeah, it took me a long time to admit that out loud because it's one of those things where if you vocalise something like that, there are usually lots of people around you who say things like, well, of course, and you'll have to get a real job too.
Yeah.
Or start suggesting, you know, the sort of things that are kind of like writing fiction but are real jobs. Which, you know, often happened, but I did. I was always interested in writing. It was something that I always knew I was going to be doing no matter what else I was doing with my life. And I discovered fantasy with a capital F when I was about 13, and I started writing. I sort of started planning novels, but I started really writing a novel, I think around about the time I was 14. And I wrote a lot of novel manuscripts through my teens before I actually got published. So it looked like I got published terribly young, and of course I did, which is I was 20 when my first novel was published. But in the whole scheme of things as a writer, I was on like my fifth or sixth book, I just started early.
And that's quite standard, really, I guess. You never really sell your very first novel. But can you tell us a bit about how you did manage to get published? And that was through winning the George Turner.
Yeah, it's quite an appalling story in that it's of no use whatsoever to aspiring writers, apart from in the generic sense of, hey, try things. Sometimes they work out.
Well, exactly.
I had a huge burst of luck. And I do think that first publication is always luck. Ideally, you've got a lot of skill in there as well, but it doesn't matter how skilled you are, you need the luck with. And I'd had a big gap because I was at university and I was having a social life and all that. And then I found out about this competition, and so I finished the book in time for the deadline, and then I almost didn't send it. But somebody made me, and so I posted it, and then I won. And that was a real shock to the system. It's one of those things, it's not replicable, like really. No. Apart from a sort of, you know, general advice to people to give things a go. Because the prize itself only lasted for 3 years. This was with Transworld that became, I think they were swallowed up by Random House. And the George Turner Prize, it was named after an Australian science fiction writer of great note who was known for writing science fiction at a time when it wasn't really something that Australians did. He was a very well-respected science fiction writer and critic. And, and the prize lasted for 3 years and then it just sort of petered away. And the premise of the competition was that you win, you got a $10,000 advance and you got publication. And, yeah, I mean, it was an amazing experience to get at the age of 20. I'm not going to sort of knock the experience of getting published at the age of 20. I think it was fantastic. But, of course, what happened was, being 20, I wasn't really in a position to capitalise on that amazing fortune of getting the leg in the door professionally at that point. So I had one follow-up book, and then things went very quiet for a long time. They weren't really quiet at this end, but if you look at my bibliography, my list of publications, it looks like there's quite a long, quiet period there in which I was frantically writing all sorts of things, but the opportunities just weren't working out. And then they started working out again. And here
Which I guess I was listening to another podcast today, and somebody was saying that, you know, one of the most important things you have to understand is that just because you've been published before doesn't guarantee you the next book.
Absolutely.
And people who have done 20, 30 books, you're still trying to sell the next book that you've written.
Yeah, and I think you find that the writers who are the most successful, apart from the ones who are so successful that they have a very branded property has so much weight to it that they can just keep putting that out for a really long time. So somebody like Lindsay Davis with the Falco novels, or Terry Pratchett, or any of those big series novels. But most really successful ongoing writers are successful because they learn to change with the wind, because mm-hmm. they can keep coming up with new different things. And yeah, and it's a struggle, because you've got to sell every book. It's like a new book. You have opportunities, you have a lot more doors open to you if you've been published before. And not necessarily the doors you think, I mean, not just the doors of publication. One of the net effects for me of being published so early was that I had pretty serious credibility enough to get work teaching creative writing as night classes, which I did for about 8 years, which was quite a necessary little income along the way. A lot of doors get opened to you for having been published, but that doesn't mean that people are always going to let you walk through the doors.
Mm. So does that scare you in some ways? I was in this same podcast, they were sort of saying that a lot of writers can be successful for a period of time, and maybe even 10 years of writing back to back, that you would consider that quite successful, and then they go off and do something else. Does that kind of, like, that you were published so young and you're still writing, and maybe you're still growing as a writer, does that factor into coming up with new pitches and new projects?
Not as such, because coming up with the new stuff is the really fun part. I mean, coming up with the next thing that I want to write is absolutely right at the top of the list of things that I love to do, and I think it's the most exciting thing for most writers. It's very rare to find a writer who's sitting in the bar wishing that they would be allowed to write the same book over and over for the next 20 years. Hmm. If anything, a greater complaint you'll find by authors is if they get stuck writing the same kind of thing and they're not allowed to write anything, or they don't feel like they can find success writing anything else. So, I mean, my ideal would be to be writing completely different things every few years. There are so many different kinds of stories that I love and that I love to write.
Still in fantasy or just completely different?
Some and some not. I've flirted with stuff that has not been fantasy. I think it's my most natural comfort zone. But even just within fantasy, there are so many different kinds of fantasy. There are so many different types of story that I could tell just within that framework. Never mind if you start, like, dipping out into other speculative fiction areas like science fiction, or looking at YA and children's stuff. But, yeah, and there's non-fantasy stuff that I want to write too. Mm-hmm. I want to do it all.
Of course. He doesn't. I guess before we move on, because I know where I want to go next, but I just wanted to touch on you never really had any formal training with actual writing in terms of, for example, writers today might look to go to Clarion or some kind of other writer's class. You wrote, you threw something out there, it stuck, and then from there it gave you the opportunity to teach other people the craft. But for you, mostly it's been self-taught?
Yes, I would say that. I did do creative writing occasionally through school or through university here and there. I deliberately chose, when I was making my university choices, to not go with creative writing, simply because I was much more interested in finding material to feed the writing demon with, as opposed to the whole writing thing itself. And largely that choice, the reason I made that choice, apart from the fact that, you know, history and classics, which is where I ended up gravitating, is such an interesting field anyway, and the whole thing of learning stuff to write books about. But also when it comes down to it, I've always loved fantasy and creative writing that is taught in academia or in schools is very rarely, you very rarely get somebody to mentor you who actually knows what the hell fantasy is or can in any way respect speculative genres. And that was generally my experience. So whether it was at secondary college or later at university, when I did dip my toe into the creative writing classes, it was interesting, but it wasn't something that was really overly useful to me because these weren't people who were interested in interrogating genre or in helping me write the best possible fantasy story. They were mostly people who were interested in trying to dissuade me from that fantasy stuff and make me write something serious. Mm-hmm. And I don't like being told what to do.
No.
So, yeah, I suppose you'd say self-taught largely from reading. And, yeah, so it is kind of odd that I went on to teach. But I'd, at least for a while there was somebody teaching adult education, creative writing, who was open to genre. And I usually would find in a class of 8 to 10 adults, there would usually be one or two who were writing fantasy or writing science fiction, and having me there as somebody who understood that and would incorporate genre aspects in quite casually while talking about, you know, mainstream writing was, I think, something that hopefully had an effect on people and, you know, did a little bit of good.
Hmm. So let's talk about the period between the second publication and I guess now when you've been picked up by a major Australian publisher and been you know, it's a good deal and you've been really well promoted and your books are available everywhere and, you know, okay, I'm just going to say it, let's say you've made it.
So basically we had 98 and 99 was the last time that I had novels, adult novels out with a big commercial publisher. And now last year is sort of, yeah, so that's 11. I don't do maths. That's 11 years between what you'd call big publications.
So if we went back to sort of the period in between the publication of your second novel and the beginning of your HarperCollins trilogy, which, you know, is a major publication, a major house, I'd love to talk about the period in between in which you were still writing and you were writing a lot of short stories too. Just in terms of you'd never lost hope about the fact that, you know, you were a writer who could sell a book and you just kept working. And I'm interested to sort of hear about how you didn't kind of lose faith or the way or belief in your own work.
It just didn't. I mean, obviously, if somebody had told me at the age of 22 that it would be another 11 years before I had a book with a mainstream publisher, there is a chance that I might have felt a little bit, you know, sad about the whole situation. But it sort of didn't seem that way at the time because there was always something around the corner. I started my postgrad degree for a start around about that time, and so I had my entire postgraduate career, which lasted for about 7 years before I got my doctorate. I was writing, absolutely. I think I had 1 year in which I wasn't writing a novel, and that was the year that I decided to write a zillion short stories and send them to as many places as possible and just basically did it quite obsessively. I think I got up to 147 submissions that year, many of which were the same story that I just sent out and sent back. I racked up a lot of rejections that year as well. It was a very good year for me because, you know, I think I sold about 15 stories, but that's an awful lot of rejections out of 147. So it taught me to deal with rejection. So there was tick. I wrote across a few different genres. I went through a phase of writing erotica under a pen name. including a short story I had published, which I got paid $500 for, which I have not topped since, I have to say, especially as it was something I wrote in a Sunday afternoon, like, absolutely just really, really quick, and $500. I mean, sadly, the magazine went bust immediately after publishing my story. But yeah, so I did that. I tried writing children's stuff for a while. I actually took, because this is back when it did take me still a year to write a novel. I've been a lot faster since then because I have children and I can't afford to take a whole year to write a novel. I did take a whole year writing a book which I knew probably wouldn't sell, which was the third book in my Moklaw series, the series mm-hmm. that had been published originally, because I kind of wanted the closure. And it was a little, and I knew that because the publishers were no longer interested in the series and there was so little chance that anybody else was going to publish a book that was really book three of it. It wasn't intended to be a trilogy originally, though. It was a standalone novel, but it was still a book three. So nobody else was going to publish it. There were actually a few people who were vaguely interested, which surprised me, but it didn't come to anything. So, yeah, and I just sort of continue on. Something that made a big difference to me and was an important part of those years was that I got basically taken under the wing of some really great writers who have mentored me and became part of a writing group that meets basically every 18 months or so, each with a massive manuscript under our arms, which we hurl at each other while drinking copious amounts of wine, which, you know, it's actually a little bit more work than that, but not a lot more work than that. I found myself mentored by these amazing writers who are very, very good at planning out careers and thinking about careers, and they really helped me tighten my thinking as a professional. I wrote lots of short fiction, as I said. I got involved in the small presses and the science fiction community, which was something I'd known nothing about when I was first published. So, yeah, I'm at a stage now where my trilogy got picked up by HarperCollins. And again, I wrote the book some time ago of this particular trilogy, but then it was a year and a half before, I think, between signing the contract and the publication of the first one, because they were giving me extra time to write. So even at the point at which it felt, yes, I'm making a sale, I'm here again, this is really cool, then there were even more delays. I think people often don't understand just how long the publishing business takes. Mm. We had a children's series that was the group of us, Raw, my writing group, that we'd pitched and sold to ABC Books. So I had a children's book out in 2007, which was fantastic. The whole series didn't end up getting published, but the first three did. So, yeah, there were false starts and lots of abandoned novels here and there. And through all of it, or through most of that period, was this book that I really believed in and that I really loved that needed a lot of work until the first book actually was in the right place at the right time. And sometimes it takes a while to get to the right place at the right time. And, yeah, and here I am. And now, yeah, it's funny because, like, The Power and Majesty, which came out last year, and as I said, I sold it maybe a year and a half before that. And then before that, there was a year in which basically it was under consideration by the publisher. And before that, there was a year of it being, like, structurally edited after I'd had some really important feedback on it. So this is a novel that's been with me a long time, has been worked on, has been left and come back to. And then it's out there, and then I had to write the second one in about 7 months. And then I had to write the third one.
So in that period of time, you also had two children.
I did. And it just occurred to me that I forgot to mention that part. No. So that filled some hours.
Well, I just wondered how much that eats into the ability to produce novels.
Well, it eats into it, absolutely. I'm not going to say it doesn't. Trying to write and have two and mother children is incredibly hard. Having said that, I had my writing habits before I had children were actually a lot less efficient than they are now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like I said, I can write a book in 7 months if pressed, as long as I take school holidays into account. I can write anywhere at the drop of a hat. I don't have to have a whole day to myself. I don't have to be at a particular place. I have ironed a lot of my preciousness out of me. And if I only have,
and I think, yeah, 15 minutes, I can professional write. Writers often say that. That's something that's that I notice a lot. It's like, I'm not, I don't need a special pen, I don't need whatever, I need 10 minutes and I'm going to sit down and write. Something that I have noticed is that it seems at this point in time that a lot of your fellow writers in Raw seem to have also managed to sell more than one book at a book in this period. Would you say that as a group you've kind of all evolved and learnt, say, over the last 10 years, or did you all just get lucky at the same time? Or have you all matured, perhaps, as writers? Does it bounce off each other?
I think there's a lot of elements of that in it. When we first formed the group, Marianne DePierre and Rowena Corey Daniels were the instigators of the group. And at the time, both, I mean, Marianne hadn't had any adult fiction sales. She'd sold some children's books, but she was, like, you know, on the cusp. Rowena was one book ahead of me with her first trilogy. So she'd like started the year before we were with the same publisher, and yeah, and there the idea behind the group is that once you get published, there's very little in the way of resources for professional development. There's an awful lot of professional development that's out there for writers who haven't made that first step yet, but once you start getting published, and there's this thing that writers will often talk about this ladder. Once you get on that first rung of the ladder, the next one is a lot closer, and often you have to start putting out books. And this is what I said, you know, that I kind of fell down on in my early 20s, that actually following up a publishing, you know, lucky strike was a very difficult thing to do. So their idea was that we would meet as a group and try and develop each other. And so we've definitely grown up as a group. I mean, I say this, for the most part, they're quite a bit older than me. I felt I was sort of the baby of the group at the beginning. We definitely have grown up together as writers, and it was just incredibly lucky in a lot of ways. I mean, for instance, I remember, I think it was our second gathering, making a comment, and Margot Lanigan had a novel that she still has never turned into a published novel. But it was a very interesting novel, I have to say. So there you go, I've read an unpublished Margot Lanigan novel. and she was like making some very, very witty comments about our various manuscripts. And I made an off-the-cuff comment that Margot needed to become the most famous of all of us because she gave really good blurb quote. And that was before Black Juice really, really took off. In fact, the first Raw, the previous Raw, had been she'd brought Black Juice to the group, and I have to say I don't think we even changed a comma. Most of our response to her manuscript was talking to her about, I guess, advice and suggestions on how to handle the manuscript and how to handle the stories and predicting that it was going to win World Fantasy, which we totally did, and it totally did. So there was nothing really that we contributed to that one. That was all Margot. On her own. But, yeah, there has been some extraordinary fortune from some of the writers, and that's really exciting to see. Others have, like me, had quiet periods and comebacks, or are due for comebacks. I think any group of writers who regularly communicate with each other and are friends and help each other with each other's manuscripts and all that, you will see, I mean, if they stick at it, there will always be the payoff, and that's definitely happened with many of them. And so, yeah, it's always very exciting. But especially when it's a manuscript that we have actually looked at in the group. Trent Jameson is a really good example. He was the first one to join our group who actually didn't have a book published when he joined the group. And more recently, of course, his Death Most Definite was published and has had quite a very good response. And, in fact, his latest fantasy sale, Royal, which he's had the cover up of on his blog and everything, it was originally, that was a Raw book before Death Most Definite was. And so it's very exciting to see a manuscript that we looked at maybe 5 years ago has made a comeback. It's, again, it's one of those things like Power and Majesty. Sometimes novels take a while to find their place. They might need to be rewritten two or three times. And sometimes if you do anything in between those two or three rewrites, suddenly it's 5 years. It doesn't mean that a manuscript is stale. Sometimes it just means that it means it needed the time to be in the right place at the right time.
Which I guess brings us to Power and Majesty. And you mentioned yes. that you have a great love of Imperial Roman women.
Yes, absolutely.
How much of this book is a response to that?
Quite a lot of it. The main thing is that in 2002, my partner and I got to go to Rome for a month. It was partly at least funded by a scholarship from the university to travel in order to do things which are good for your thesis. And that was what I did. I was actually looking at statues of Imperial Roman women. But the side effect of this trip was that we spent a month in Rome, which is one of the most amazing cities in the world. And because it doesn't have very good public transport, we walked everywhere. And it was a few years later that when I was really starting to coalesce my ideas about the creature court and the city of Alfleur, and the city of Rome that I'd walked over for that month just ended up being the geographical frame for the novel, which, as it turned out, when my mother and I sat down to draw the maps for the books, turned out that the Rome in my head was actually not very much like the real city of Rome at all, which for copyright purposes is probably a good thing. So there was that. That was one of the early instigators. And as far as the story itself, it has a lot of influences, but one of the biggest influences was actually going back to my honours degree, which was on the role of women in the Roman religion. And some books that I read for that, particularly Ovid's Fasti, which is a famous book. Well, it's not famous at all. It's a very obscure work of poetry from quite a famous Roman Roman poet. And this book is basically a calendar of festivals. And I became quite obsessed with the Roman festivals and the fact that they had so many. And most people don't really think that they actively celebrated all the festivals that are written down in that book, which was so complex that he actually only got 7 months into the year before he fell over. But I just started imagining what kind of world did have that many festivals that were actively celebrated, and that became the heart of the book, really. That's the world, the daylight world, that's a big part of the book, is that this is a city that is so devoted to the celebration of festivals that it's become an industry in itself, which in some ways is, you know, a comment on modern life as well, because, I mean, we all still have our, whether it's not so much the religious aspect, because actually there is a background religious aspect to the festivals, but it's not an overt thing. I'm thinking more of the social festivals that we go through in our culture, and how every culture has different ones. I just love festivals. It's just one of those things that is just meat and drink to story. You know, it sparks off all sorts of things. So there was that as well. There are a few other little Roman history tidbits here and there, and other historical things as well. There's quite a bit of Victoriana, and I threw in quite a bit of 1920s in my head anyway. I'm not sure how much of that actually does come out in the final manuscript. But certainly in my head, there's a 1920s soundtrack through the book, and that's what a lot of the fashions are centred around. So it's pretty much a big melting pot of all my favourite things of history. The Roman stuff is there.
And you described this book to me as, Elise, this is it's a big fat fantasy, but it's not. It's
not big. Well, that was because I was trying to get you to read it.
Yeah, I know. In what ways would you say it deviates from a standard big fat fantasy? Because there's three volumes.
Well, I could probably sit here and talk for an hour about how actually there's no such thing as a standard big fat fantasy, and you're terribly prejudiced. But I won't. I'll leave that aside. If you actually look at the books that I've written, they don't really work as fantasy at all. The only reason that people might see it as epic fantasy, apart from, you know, the cover and all that sort of thing, is because it's set in an other fantasy world. That's absolutely the case. But the story structure is actually much closer to urban fantasy. I mean, this is basically, you know, it's Buffy in slightly longer skirts in a lot of ways. It's a story of a woman who is exposed to this world that she didn't realise existed, that was going on in the dark shadows of the night, and she has to repeatedly save the city from destruction. In some ways, it's quite a small-scale story because it's just about the one city. It later expands, the trilogy expands to encompass two other cities as part of the story. But really, it's a story about one city, and so it is very much urban fantasy. It's just not urban fantasy set in our world. And so it has a lot of elements that you'll see probably more in urban fantasy than people would certainly expect in traditional fantasy. So you've got, you know, quite a bit of smut and black leather and people changing into things. And it's not quite vampires and it's not quite werewolves, but there are elements of both.
Naked boys falling from the sky.
There are naked boys falling from the sky, and that's not the only nudity either. I think that opening scene definitely. It is important, I think, and this is a lesson I've taken from Margot Lanigan. You know, I think it's very important to say in the first chapter what kind of book this is going to be, and mine is a book in which naked boys fall from the sky.
But conversely to that, something that really affected me quite deeply in the first book is something quite horrible happens to one of the girls who was sharing a house with our main character.
Yes.
And what you didn't do was you didn't wrap that up in a chapter and move on. It sort of brings a real darkness to a large chunk because it's not something that she could cover from really quickly, and you wouldn't expect her to.
Well,
and then she just she wasn't really that fun anymore.
No, well, that's sort of, it's interesting because to me, I don't think of the book that way because I wrote it in the wrong order. And the whole, pretty much the first third of the book wasn't there in the first draft. And people kept making me go back and say, no, you've got to actually go back to this point and tell us more of this. So that was actually supposed to be a backstory. And then I actually had to write the scene, which was actually quite confronting because I'd never planned to.
Yeah.
Originally, the point of that part of the story is that Velody, my heroine, and her two best friends who she lives with and who she shares a life with, they all kind of work together and they share their business. I wanted them to have something that had brought the three of them together and affected them, and to show that even though the story is really about the daylight world and the Nox, which is the night world, and how these are two very separate worlds, I also wanted to show that they're not innocents just because they belong to a daylight world and they don't know about the monsters yet, and to show that actually just because this world is daylight and that one is Nox doesn't mean that the daylight is all ribbons and honey cakes. You know, there are bad things that happen in that too. Having said that, yeah, I can't say much more about that, but it is very important to the plot. Another element that I actually really wanted to get in there is it's about female friendship and about how three women who are very close friends would all react to a really terrible terrible happening. They all react differently. And it affects their friendship. In some ways it makes them closer, in some ways it sort of actually puts a barrier between them. And their friendship is a really important core of the novel and will expand and become important in different ways in later books, which I can't talk about.
So how important is it to you to have strong, complex female characters at the core of your books?
Well, it's compulsory. I don't really know how to write any other way. I do want to regularly re-examine my own definitions of strong women and complex women and all that sort of thing. And I do rather like, although it's much harder for me, writing male protagonists. And in a lot of ways I think it's really important to write complex, different male protagonists too. But what the women are doing is always of interest to me, particularly in fantasy, because we have an amazing history of fantasy, of women characters in fantasy and women writers of fantasy. And a lot of that gets forgotten when people compose an image in their head of what the genre looks like. And I always think that's a shame, because for me, I may have started reading David Eddings when I was 13, but I also started reading Jennifer Robinson and Marion Zimmer Bradley, and the women writers are just so important to me, and the role of the female characters. And I think in any form of fiction, you will often find that women get the short end of the stick as characters, and often they don't get as wide a range of possible destinies as the male characters do. And that to me is not just a shame, it's also an opportunity, because it means that I get to sort of play in an area that maybe hasn't been quite so deeply trod. Not that I would say that there aren't already a wealth of amazing female characters and writers out there, but, you know, I think it's an important thing to do. And like I said, I mean, my specialty in academic terms is historical Roman women, women with power and women who didn't have power and why they didn't have power. And so I've basically been training my whole life to write about why women are interesting in stories. And the good thing about, if you have a big cast, and The Creature Court is the first time that I've really had such a massive cast. It's the most point of view characters I've ever had in a novel or a story. It has a really, really big cast. It has a lot of female characters. I mean, it has quite a few male protagonists as well, but the good thing about having a lot of women in your cast is you can do a lot of different things with them. And, you know, yeah, you can have a wimpy, annoying, slutty one who screams a lot because you've got so many others to balance her out. And having said that, the one that possibly makes me say that is one of my favourite characters. So that was just me being bitchy about her.
Well, I hate her, so anyway.
We'll see.
What hints can you give us for The Shattered City? Those of us who are hanging on the edge of our seats for the second book.
Well, I've actually had to sort of talk about this quite a bit lately with interviews and things like that, and it makes me, because I think we didn't come up with a very descriptive blurb for the second book, largely because it's really hard to talk about it without giving lots and lots and lots of spoilers. Lots of awesome stuff happens. it very much explores deeper into the world that we've already seen and into the history that we've already seen. So one thing I like about this book, and I'm really happy with, especially having just this week finished the copy edits on the third book, is that it's a story with a lot of history to it. It's got a lot of backstory, which is actually really hard to write. But all my characters have these long, complex, torturous histories with each other. There's lots of angst, and the second story absolutely wraps that up. Basically, it's about my main protagonist, Velody, being a leader and what kind of leader she is and the kind of changes she can make to this strange world of monsters that she's ended up in. And it's also about what's going to happen when all that gets taken away. So I basically I'm allowing everybody to be strong and complex and interesting and fight the good fight, and then I'm going to rip an awful lot of stuff out from under their feet and make them fall in a heap and see what happens. And I know what happens. It's terribly exciting. And we're going to see a little bit more of the other cities, and even more in the third book as far as the other cities that are part of the story. So we will occasionally sort of set foot outside Alfler, which is the city at the heart of it all. So, yes.
And Shattered City is out in April?
In April, yes, which is very, very soon. possibly by the time this comes out, it may be out on shelves. Yes, it is. It is due out imminently, and I'm very excited about having it out there. And
I would be a bad interviewer if I didn't mention your other book that will also be coming out.
Yeah, you should probably mention that.
In May, I believe.
I'm hoping so.
Which is a 4-short story collection with 12 Planet Press.
Yes.
Which is also centred around your love of Roman imperial women.
Far more so, I would say, than The Creature Court. The Creature Court has elements, but Love and Roman Punk is just utterly steeped in, yeah, probably whatever issues remain in my head from the fallout from the PhD, I think, got funneled into this collection. Absolutely. And I'm very excited about this book too.
Yeah, I guess I'm saying really in some ways, you said before that you were interested in your research, you were interested in Roman women who had power and who didn't and why. And then in Love and Roman Punk, you've kind of made almost all the women be extremely powerful.
I have. And, yeah, it's the thing. Once you start writing, this is something I've never really sort of talked about. Rome and Rome's history is so important to me that actually I've never been able to write anything set there. I've dabbled in it from time to time. I've never done it successfully. This is the first time I've really done it, because the trouble with, once you know any period of history quite intimately, mostly what you learn is how much you still have to learn. So writing historical fiction is bad enough if you've just done a quick crib session over the weekend with a few textbooks. But if you know, like, all the gaps in the history, or even that you don't know where all the gaps are, the more you know, the scarier it is. So I was actually quite scared writing ancient Rome, especially considering I do take a lot of liberties, let's face it, with the characters and with the background. But I've always wanted to write an ancient Rome that had a layer of magic superimposed over it. I didn't realise I was going to do something quite so surreal as I ended up doing with these stories, but I love it to bits. Agrippina, who is at the centre of the linchpin story of the collection, I think, the one that all the others kind of dangle pushily off. Agrippina is one of the most fascinating women in history. And, in fact, the only kind of thing that I regret in some ways about this collection is that I couldn't write it and side with both Livia and Agrippina, who are my two favourites, because they hated each other. So Livia gets to be the villain because Agrippina is the protagonist of that story. I could write it very differently. Someday I am going to write the novel in which Livia is the protagonist and everybody else is the villain, because I do love her so much. She's a very important historical character to me. but Agrippina is wonderful, and, like, her life was just such a soap opera, like a really insane soap opera. You start telling people about Agrippina and what she was actually, you know, the stuff that we actually have down as historical facts, never mind the sort of, like, the fuzzier ends of the actual stories people came up with, because one of the things that Roman women have in common is that they were utterly vilified in the existing texts. We have very few historical texts that don't vilify Roman women, largely because a lot of historians normally were writing about the family before the family currently in charge, and one of the ways that they would represent how corrupt and evil the previous ruling family had been was to talk about how vicious, horrible, slutty, bad the women of the family were. So, and because we have so few historical documents pertaining to the women, that's kind of all we've got in a lot of ways. So you end up with this weird, skewed version of history in which you've got these insane harridans seducing everybody and poisoning everybody else and getting exiled to islands. And it's actually just a really weird alternate history. that sadly we kind of have to put up with because we don't have the sensible documents that tell us, for instance, how well those women were regarded during the time that their families were actually in power, when people wouldn't have gone around saying appalling things about them in text, in print, which is actually what my thesis was all about. It was about the public image, the positive public image of Roman imperial women. So Roman history is basically already an alternate history, so I don't think that I'm actually taking too many liberties just by adding manticores and vampires and werewolves and Lamia and everything else. There's a lot of everything else. Basilisk. So I created that one story which just, it was just one of those stories that just pours out of you. And it was just a story that wanted to be told, and I looked at it, and I looked at it sideways, and I backed away from it, and I said, are you sure about this? and the other stories in the collection all, as I said, they hinge off it. They're all part of the universe created by that first story, which I'm very pleased that it all sort of ties together so nicely. So this is the Agrippinaverse. It is the alternate universe in which Agrippina and her sisters were superheroes, kind of like Charlie's Angels, but with more harpies. And yeah, and then I wrote the future of that world, and it was an awful lot of fun, and I hope people will like the collection because it's just so me. I think it's more me possibly than anything I've ever written. Of course, when I'm looking at the Creature Court books, I think that one is the most me. But, you know, Love and Roman Punk is slightly more recent, so. Yeah.
And so where to now for the kind of stories that you're telling? What's next?
Well, it's a very exciting year for me because I'm done with the Creature Court trilogy. I mean, this is a series that I have been working on longer than my six-year-old daughter has been alive. So having that done is quite an odd feeling. But it's onwards and upwards. It's all always about the next thing. And this year I get to write my Nancy Napoleon novel that I'm very excited about because I got a grant to write this year. So it hasn't sold to a publisher yet. Hopefully that's something that will happen sometime over the year. But it's kind of nice to not be pressured, to know that I've already basically been paid for the book. Now I get to make it as good as I possibly can and very much hope that I will be selling it. So yes, that's the plan. But it's sort of odd to sort of be looking at the year ahead and realise that actually all my editing's done. I don't have any other sort of big crashing commitments, and I don't technically have any deadlines yet, except that I have to produce a book for the Australia Council by the end of the year. But that's ages away.
And you failed to mention that actually it's quite rare for a fantasy author to get a grant to write.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's been a lot of change in the way that the grants bodies are set up, and it's certainly not easy. But I think that people like Margot Lanigan and Sean Williams, who have, you know, represented fantasy so well working for the Australia Council and kind of shown the way, shown that genre fiction actually can also be amazing, you know, can also be amazing books, and that the two things are not mutually exclusive, has been a huge change that's happened over the last decade. And so, yeah, it is now possible. It's still not easy. I've had people kind of covertly asking me how I did it to wrangle, you know, substantial grant money for a fantasy book. And it, you know, obviously there's a bit of luck, but it's also going to be the right project. And I knew I wanted to apply for lots of grants next time I had a big sale. That just made sense, because saying things like I have just, you know, sold a trilogy to HarperCollins is the sort of thing that tends to get grant bodies quite excited. Sadly, it's always the case where they're more likely to give the money to people who sort of appear to not need it in some ways. Like, the more successful you can prove you are, the more likely people are to give you money. So there was that. Not that I'm hugely successful, but it was like having a success to capitalise on. But also it was the right project. I mean, Nancy Napoleon is a much – this is urban fantasy set in Yeah, it's a version of our world which also happens to have lots of monsters in it. But it becomes an easier sell. For a start, being set in our world automatically means you can make it sound a bit closer to a novel that, you know, Australia Council decision makers might understand. Because it's set in Tasmania, which is, you know, is my home. It's able to bring in Australian content, which fantasy often isn't able to do. You can have other world fantasy that brings in Australian aspects, but it's a lot harder to do. And not that grants only go to novels set in Australia, but you often have to prove criteria, like that this is something that is going to be relevant to people of Australia, that it will be part of our voice, and that, yeah, all that sort of thing. So it was a novel that was easy to explain in grant body attracting terms. And, you know, it's also one that I'm hugely excited about writing. So just everything happened to be in the right place at the right time. So I was very lucky. And, yeah, it's just so exciting to be starting something new. Because, as I said, it's been over 6 years, really, since I started a new world. And Nancy, of course, you know, sort of mentioned before, I already wrote a novelette starring this heroine, which won the Washington Prize. So I've already made a little bit of a start. It's not completely something new, but it's a new novel. It's a new, hopefully, series. And there are other things on the horizon too. I have another probably trilogy fantasy series in mind that I'm very excited about that utilises a lot of Shakespeare elements with necromancy. So that is lots of fun, and it's sort of just on the horizon waiting for me to pounce on it and write it. I have YA projects I'm very excited about working on. I always have several irons in the fire, several projects ready to go at a moment's notice. And being a writer, I'm always thinking of the next new thing that I really want to do. So, yeah, that part isn't a chore at all. Fitting it in is tricky, but, you know, my second child is getting older now, and in a couple of years she'll be off to kinder, and then the world will be my oyster, and I'll be able to write a zillion novels every year. That's the plan. It's a good plan.
Well, I wanted to thank you very much for joining me today for the interview, and I wanted to again say that The Shattered City will be out in April in every good bookshop across Australia and online. And thank you very much.
Thank you.